Hi, I'm Nikki. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi,
family. And I want to say thank you very much. And one of the things that didn't get mentioned is my home group. It's the Abernathy group, and I'm really proud to belong to that group here in Sandy Springs. I have so many things that have happened to me over the last 29 years and 10 months that I've tried very hard to just put the highlights of it, but of course I can't tell you everything. I can't tell you everything because some things you don't need to know. But anyway, we'll write it off to lack of time, okay? Alcoholics Anonymous was 8 years old when I was born, and I was very fortunate to be born into a family with a famous father and a very well-known mother who was beautiful. And they taught me, because my father was a football player and a baseball player, and he even, when he was 23 or 24, took St. John's College to the head of the basketball New England championship or something. So everybody just loved them. So if you are the child of a football player, baseball player, championship coach, everybody loves you and everybody knows you. That's how it is if there's sports in your family. I was second of eight, and I was baptized Michaela Murray, and we were raised with the team concept. Everything, that's right. Even putting the groceries away, we all had a shelf to put things on. That's how we did it. So it was really useful when I came into AA. Everything was really kind of golden. I had an Irish twin, Peggy. She was 13 months older than me, and Mary was just 2 months younger. And just after that, my sister Patricia was born. Now, here's a tragedy, because she died from sudden infant death syndrome. But in those days, they would tell you not to talk about it, so it wouldn't upset my mother, as if nobody else lived in the family. But anyway, that was obviously not the right thing to do, because I noticed that my mother was different after Patricia died. But life went on. Thank God they had a good marriage. Many, many people get a divorce when there's a tragedy like that because it's so painful. But they didn't, and they stayed together, and they had 4 more children. So I don't think they could leave each other. Anyway, the second thing that happened was when I was 14 years old, I was swimming in the Atlantic Ocean, diving with some Catholic priests from Ireland. I have to be careful here because I just ran into a lady from Ireland. I don't want to break anybody's anonymity in that country. But anyway, the bishop had asked us to make sure these priests didn't drown because we had had a storm out in the Atlantic Ocean. And the waves were very, very high, maybe 12 feet, and we were riding waves. And you would wear a bathing suit that day you never intended to wear again because it would be filled with sand in the seams. So you would just throw it away at the end of a day like that. And that was the day I disobeyed my father, but obeyed the priest. I guess I was in conflict. And I dove off his shoulders, even though I had been told never to do that. But the priest so much wanted me to, and he just said I was such a good swimmer, and I broke my neck. Yes. And that was the same month that Roy Campanella was on the cover of Life magazine. We had the exact same injury, and he was paralyzed and I was not. So I was lucky that day. I think the next thing that, you know, really became part of my problem is that the Brown University football team doctor, who was a specialist in neck injuries, took me on. Knowing that we had this great big Irish Catholic family, he gave me my medicine for free, telling me it wouldn't get me into any trouble, but it would take care of the pain of the neck injury. It was Darvon compound, and I had an unlimited supply of it. And anybody in my high school that needed anything for pain, cramps, anything, they just came to me. I have plenty. I did not realize, but I was trying to tell the doctor, I think I'm taking that when I don't need it. And he said, well, don't worry, it's fine. They said so, it's in the literature. I said, okay, so I'm still on it. But have a goal. I want to get out of the neck brace. I want to go to college without a neck brace, without the pills. And every time I tried to go without the pills, I would have such a stomach ache. It got to the point I felt like there was a knife being drawn through my stomach, and sometimes it would throw me on the ground. So my mother and father thought, well, we can't have that, no matter what it is. Just take those pills until they can find out what's wrong with you. So, okay, I took the pills. I didn't have the pain, but they decided to do surgery on me between my freshman and sophomore year in college, which you cannot see withdrawal, so they cut and cut and cut, and then they said, well, we don't find anything. Sewed me up and put me back on the pills. So that didn't solve that problem, but I decided I've got to get off these pills. Now, occasionally, we would do funny things, like college kids will. We'd go to New York City, go to the NIT, drink. But I would have like a diluted drink, like 7 and 7, or something like that. I try to remember what I was drinking by the name of the street I was drinking on. 7th Avenue, 7 and 7. So it's how to keep it simple. Well, I would go through like 4 dates in the night because they'd run out of money. So I was staying in the Manhattan Hotel and then with a bunch of girls. And the next day, 5 of those guys, including my boyfriend who had run into the 4 guys, were around my bed. They said, there is something wrong with you. I said, what? And they said, you've got a wooden leg. I said, what's that? They said, well, you drink, and we can't keep up with you. You drink too much. And I said, that's because I'm Irish. And you know, don't worry, it's okay. So went back to school, and that's kind of how I ran my life during that time. Shortly into my freshman year, we also found out that Mom and Dad were having their 8th baby. And Jimmy died in March of 1962. That was tough, and then I had that confrontation about me drinking too much. And then lo and behold, don't we have the Cuban Missile Crisis, and my boyfriend that I was going to marry and I was deeply in love with gets called off to the Cuban Missile Crisis. I thought, he's not coming back. I'm going to have to find somebody else. I had no confidence. No confidence. The only thing he had shown me is that he could light a fire without a match. I thought, I don't know how that's going to work in Cuba. But anyway, he went off. I missed him so badly. But you know, I was trained not to talk about it, so I wasn't telling anybody. But I so much wanted to go to this one St. Patrick's Day dance. I even went out and bought myself a new green dress, about the color of this. And I thought, well, somebody will ask me to that St. Patrick's Day dance just because I'm Irish. I said, sure enough. So he says, well, don't you think we should go out and get to know each other a little bit? And I said, yeah. So he said, let's go have a drink. I said, I don't like drinks. I really don't like a drink. Don't waste your money on a drink for me. He said, Al, get her a scotch. I said, I don't like scotch. I've had that at the Brown University frat parties. I don't like scotch. Al, put a twist on it. Al put a twist on it, and I drank it. And I'm telling you, I felt so good. I felt relief hit me from my head to my toes. Like I would never, ever, ever have another problem, ever, as long as I lived. All I had to do was drink scotch, and life would be perfect. So the next day I'm thinking, well, we're going out tomorrow night. So we go to the Lincoln Country Club. He gets busy because he's running the party or something. He's the fraternity president. And I go to the bar. And I introduce myself to the bartender. I'm Mickey. And I'm going to stand here at the end of the bar. And when you see me at the end of the bar, put up a scotch with a twist. And just put it on his tab. See that man over there? Put it on his tab. And so I would just do that. And all night long, the bartender told me at the end of the night, anytime you're here at a dance or any other occasion, make sure I'm on, because the bar was good tonight with you there. I said, good. So I became a daily drinker. I just told my date on the way home, I would like you to make sure that Al knows what I like, and if there's any place else we could have a little sip of something on the other end of campus, that would be good too. And he arranged that. So I didn't have to get a drink, I didn't have to say what I wanted, it was just served to me. Because I was a minor, I was a teenager, I wasn't supposed to be drinking. But I loved it. Now my college professors didn't love it, because now they could smell me. I'm going to the classes and they're going, Mickey, what are you doing? I said, I'm doing geography. What's the problem? You know? They go, no, Mickey, it seems like, you know, maybe you're drinking a little too much. I said, no, I'm Irish. I'm fine. So, you know, they couldn't argue with my grades. They pretty much got straight A's, occasional B. As long as they had my alcohol, I was fine. And, as long as I, you know, didn't have to feel any pressure about giving up anything so that I could have a drink. So I drank, and we had a lot of fun in the years from 63, 64, 65. It was sad on some reasons because that was the year President Kennedy got killed. It was the year of civil rights movements, but we had so much fun going on civil rights walks and testing things, and we were just very, very close as a community in Rhode Island, trying to do some new things. So of course I had to marry him, right? So we got married at the end of college. I had been working down at Senator Pell's office in Washington, D.C., and I had also been working for Governor Chafee on the Children in Youth Society, and they were letting me do courses from Washington, D.C., which was perfect. I could drink. They didn't know it. I'd send in my, you know, whatever they had required, and I'd get my A. So they said, for this last thing, Mickey, you have to show up on campus. I said, oh, what do I have to do? They said, you have to come and defend your thesis. I said, no problem. I'll be there. And by the way, Mickey, you have to take a test. What kind of a test? Just everybody has to take it, Mickey. Just show up in that auditorium and take this test. Well, I don't want to take that test. I have to go defend my thesis. That's not till 2 o'clock, Mickey. Go take this test. Okay, I went and I take the test. I go defend my thesis. I graduate, I get married, and 11 months later, Kathleen Marie is born. She's partially named after me. So I am now getting a little uptight because I couldn't drink very much when I was pregnant. It wasn't because the doctor told me not to drink. They actually used to say, don't change anything. If you were doing it before you got pregnant, do it after you get pregnant. Even horseback riding? Yep. Skiing? No problem. Okay. And so I, you know, didn't get any kind of direction about not doing this or anything. We just kind of carried on. But I was shaky because I couldn't drink. I was so nauseous, which is good. I'm so glad Kathleen was born perfect. But I was very uncomfortable, and I only gained 3 pounds with her, and only 6 with my second one. It wasn't good. So I was probably way more into my addiction than I realized, way more. And of course, the second Kathy was born, my husband went away for 2 weeks, and I just brought out the wine and had a good time. Because I had read somewhere that was good to bring in milk in the breast. I said, well, I'll take care of that. So I don't know. She got plenty of sleep anyway. That's probably kind of we were having a good time. Kathy and I were on our own for a couple of weeks. And thank God that she's turned out just fine. But I had a little problem in my marriage. My marriage was to a man that didn't want me to have any money. I'm talking not a penny. and he would like maybe leave enough food for me when he'd be gone for a couple of weeks, or have his secretary drop in and find out if I needed any bread. I said, no, but bring me a bottle. Anyway, he didn't like the idea of his secretary buying a bottle, so he, you know, over the years managed to have my liquor charged and delivered to me. But I had no car and I had no money, and I thought, this is great. I will get Kathy into a stroller and we're going to go look for money. So we go finding money on the street, and he'd say, well, you walk the baby a lot. I said, well, I'm going to the library. So I had, you know, I wanted some lipstick, a little nail polish. I couldn't get anything. But he said, well, where'd you get that lipstick? I said, Mary bought it for me, my other sister. Well, where did you get that nail polish? Well, my sister Peggy bought it. Oh, okay. Well, he didn't mind if someone else paid for it, you know. So I was going along this way, and everything seemed to be uncomfortable, but I was hiding it with my alcohol. He wasn't coming home for dinner, but I'd hide that with my alcohol. If I confronted him, he'd stay out longer, so I hid that with my alcohol. Alcohol solved everything. So I began to talk to the priest in my parish. I just didn't think it was right that I didn't have any money. So he told me to be a better cook and to pray more. And I learned to be a good cook and prayed more, but I still didn't get any money. So I went to see an attorney, and the attorney, you know, told me that that probably wasn't a marriage that was going to last. That rather distressed me, but I wanted to know what my rights were. But I couldn't remember what the attorney said because I would be drunk and hungover when I went. They would say something like, don't talk to other men. I said, how can I talk to other men? I'm in the house with a baby. You know, there's nothing happening there. So then I got so uptight I started to go to a psychiatrist. And that was the first time I tried to quit smoking. That didn't work. Psychiatrist put me on more pills. Now, see, it was like 67. Now, they think every woman has a Valium deficiency, right? Now I've got Valium. I still have some of my Darvon, but I'm beginning to think maybe I shouldn't mix those. So I buy a pillowcase to match every pill I get, and make sure I don't mix my pills. If I didn't know what I took, I'd just check my pillowcase. Oh, I took the purple pill. Oh, I took the pink pill, whatever. And every night I'm drinking. It was just really important to make sure the baby got to bed and then I could drink. And that's how I live my life. And he got another promotion. And we moved to New Jersey, right outside of New York City. This was the time that Playboy Club was really getting good. So I would just say, well, let's go. Go to Playboy Club. I learned the bunny dip. And made sure I got a good bottle of wine. That would cost about $200-$300 every time we went into New York City. He said, Mickey, I don't think you should go to New York City that much. I said, I like it. You know, he said, well, we can't afford that. So he would make sure whatever kind of wine I got when I went to the Playboy Club, he had it delivered to the house. Meantime, he moved himself to Kentucky. I was lonely, but the guys in the neighborhood would come by to visit, and we had a lot of jokes about it, and if something went wrong in the house, they'd fix it, and they would call like themselves the Monday night guy, the Tuesday night guy, but they were wonderful to me. And I am getting very, very nervous about the fact that my husband's hardly home at all. And it was a conflict for me, so the only way I knew how to handle conflict was to drink more. So that's what I did, drank more. So he decides it would do me good to go camping, and he buys a little camper. It had no bathroom, so, you know, and it was winter. So I would have to put on these boots and put on all this paraphernalia. We were in the mountains of New Jersey, or maybe Pennsylvania, I'm not sure. And he would light a big bonfire. And then I'd drink wine by the fire and get colder and colder, and he'd be gone. He and Kathleen went, I don't know what they were doing. They'd go somewhere, and I'd fall asleep. And one time, this is the true story, my boots caught on fire because I had gotten cold, and I kept moving closer and closer to the fire. I didn't know there were so many people in those woods. They came running. What's the matter? What's burning? I go, oh my God, my boots are on fire. And let me tell you, it was black. It was worse than any diesel you've ever seen come out of a truck. And I'm thinking, I shouldn't be breathing that. I'm pregnant, right? So I go in, and I'm going so fast because I was so embarrassed. And they go, what is the matter with you? I said, I'm just pregnant. You know, I'm fine. And they go, oh, she's pregnant. Like, that explained it. But anyway, I fell off a ladder that day trying to put myself up in the bunk of this camper he had bought. I said, Dave, I don't think this is going to work. Me camping. I'm not a camper. I don't think this is good. I'm the type that should check into, like, a Westin. Not a camping time. And unfortunately, right after that, I lost that baby. And I hope it never had anything to do with inhaling that smoke or falling off that ladder. And I've told this to my home group because I didn't want them to hear it here first. But I was so drunk that they had to wait to do surgery on me until I was sober enough to have surgery. I went in at 10 o'clock on a Saturday night. I was not sober enough to have that surgery until 4:30 on a Sunday morning. Do you think you get the top crew at 4:30 on a Sunday morning in the emergency surgery? Well, I lost a lot of blood, but being the team concept that we learned, my father sent my sister Martha with me. Martha said was going to take care of the baby. Take care of me until I got well. She was a straight-A student, and thanks be to God, she didn't lose any of her grades and still got into the University of Tennessee. Right after that, I get pregnant again. Thanks be to God, I had a healthy baby, and her name is Cynthia Marie. Again, I couldn't eat very much. I was a little queasy the whole time. The doctor knew it, and he was a good guy, managed to serve me alcohol in the hospital on a tray every 2 hours. Every 2 hours. I said, are you sure I should be having that? He said, it's good for your headache, Mickey. I said, well, good then, bring me more. It's good for me. So he went there, and it was actually brought in on a medicinal tray. So I said, well, that does help my headache. I don't remember a headache anymore after that. We got moved to Houston, and let me tell you, that was a dramatic change for me. The women in Houston did not drink like the women in New York and New Jersey. They got up in the morning and played tennis. They moved around. They met each other. They went to the pool. I'm going, this isn't good. I'm going to have to change something here. I don't know what it is I'm going to change. So I'm again lonely because my husband is so busy managing the big office of Houston, and I'm expecting me to entertain everybody. Which I love giving a party. That was no problem. But I was so unhappy, and I didn't think things were right. And I didn't want to tell anybody in Houston because everybody I knew in Houston was either a neighbor or they worked for him. I wasn't able very much to get out and meet anybody. So I decided to write to Dear Abby. Only I didn't want the return letter from Dear Abby to come to my house. So I decided to rent a post office box. And when I got to the postal department, they said, what's your name and address? I said, why do you need my name and address? They said, so we can mail you a renewal. I said, a renewal of what? He said, the post office box. I said, oh, okay. I left. I'm not giving them my name and address. So I went home, opened up the white pages, found somebody, and their name, their address, went back to the post office, filled her name in. I even had a zip code and a phone number. Those phone books were very handy. And I got a post office box, and I made sure that when I wrote to Dear Abby, I signed this lady's name that I found in the white pages. And I waited and waited and waited, and I told Dear Abby everything. I took my first fourth step with Dear Abby. You know what she did? Finally, she writes back. This is how paranoid I was getting. And I'm on more pills with the alcohol at this point. I was afraid to have that key in the house, so I buried it. So I buried it under the second shrub outside our house. So I was the second born child. I said, surely I can remember that. I went back, unburied the key, cleaned it off, went back to the post office box, opened the letter, written to this lady. And you know what she says? You need help. I thought, you know what? I could write that column. You know, you need help. You need professional help and I care. Please write to me again. That's what she said. So I turned in the key, never thinking that that lady got a renewal notice for that post office box. I had 5 years of sobriety before I realized if she had a husband, he's probably saying, what post office box did you have? And she's going, I don't have a post office box. Yeah, you do. It's right here. Look at the card. I know. You had to fill it out and sign it. So I obviously wasn't at the top of my game. I was getting lonelier, so I would invite in the Mormons. Do you know how nice they are? They always come in pairs, and that way I didn't have to drink alone. It was ideal, because they wouldn't have any alcohol. So I had it all to myself. They'd had water, I'd have wine, and I had company, and they had a listener, and I learned all about Mormonism. Ask me anything. They came several times. They even brought their supervisor. And I really thought they were all very, very nice, but finally I decided that's getting too much pressure. Too much pressure. That's not fun anymore. So I told the truth. I'm Catholic. Why did you do that? I said, I'm Irish. That's the explanation for everything. And I'm getting headaches. So I demanded to get a sales call from the Martini and Rossi salesman, and they came right to my house. They rang the doorbell. I said, who are you? We're the Martini and Rossi salesman. I said, come right in. They said, so-and-so down at the liquor store tells me that you're having a problem with our Martini and Rossi vermouth. I said, yes, I'm getting a lot of headaches. And I'm thinking of not using Martini and Rossi vermouth anymore. I said, but I hate to just drink straight scotch because I might become an alcoholic. So I wanted to make sure I diluted it with something. But I was positive it was the vermouth from Martini and Rossi. And they assured me they wanted to keep me happy because they knew I was a good customer. Do you know, the whole time I was in Houston, the only person that knew me and my kids by name, first name, was the liquor guy. That's not good, because I did go to the supermarket every week, but they didn't know my name. He knew my name. It was getting harder and harder to keep my act together. And just before Halloween of 1973, my dear grandfather died. This is one of my favorite stories. If you're getting tired, just go ahead and close your eyes. We go to the funeral, right? I fly up from Houston, Grandpa's getting buried, and they used to own a funeral home. So we had a lot of limousines, a lot of people. It was very nice. And it was a windy Rhode Island day. It was like November 2nd, and all my sisters and brothers and husbands and everybody are in one Cadillac or another. And the funeral director opens the door, and all this wind and leaves blow in. And this little old lady, he said, we need to get one more seat. He pulls out this invisible seat from the back of the limousine, a little drop-down seat that those Delta flight attendants use. And she would just kind of like, whew, she sits down and straightens out a little veiled hat. And she goes, which one are you? So we did the little routine we all have been going through since we were little kids. I'm the oldest, I'm Peggy, I'm second, I'm Michaela. And she answers, she goes, that's nice, it's good to see you all. If you wasn't in a shame, your grandfather was an alcoholic. I said, what? There was, you could have heard a pin drop in that Cadillac. So we went to bury Grandpa, and of course the Irish party was back at our house. Everybody came back to our house, and the second I could, I got my father. I said, Dad, did you know that Grandpa was an alcoholic? He goes, shh, don't tell your mother. I said, she doesn't know her father was an alcoholic? He said, no, she knows, but she never wanted you to know. I said, oh, okay. That explained a lot of things, like why she was always telling us not to let the neighbors know what we were doing. I used to say to my sister, what's wrong with what she's doing? She's cooking a ham. But you know, it was kind of a family rule in an alcoholic family. But my mom and dad weren't alcoholics, so we didn't really have a reason for the rule. We were just passing on the rule, following the rule for no secret, right? I said, okay, Mom, I won't tell anybody you're cooking a pork roast. I didn't understand my mother all the time. Anyway, Dad said, yeah, Grandpa was an alcoholic. And I thought, you know, that kind of explains why I'm drinking so much. Maybe I should look at my drinking. So I go back to Houston. I cut out the phone number for Alcoholics Anonymous, along with, you know, if you took an overdose, if your child did this or that. They had this emergency line. And I put it on the inside of my kitchen cupboard. I thought, no, okay, Alcoholics Anonymous number's right there if I'm ready for it. When I was getting jobs back in high school and college, they used to have the help wanted gender classified by gender. All the men first, all the women second. I used to make a lot of money as a waitress, serving alcohol, right? So right after you'd finish all those little ads, it says, do you have a drinking problem? If you do, call AA. That was true in Rhode Island, New Jersey, Houston. I thought, you know, that's what I'll do. If I ever have a problem with alcohol, I'm going to call AA. I think I decided that when I was 17. Anyway, I had the number, and I was saying, I'm just going to really try hard not to drink and really try hard not to take those pills. Now, of course, I don't have much confidence in myself because I didn't really do good when I tried to stop, you know. So for the next 9 months, the more I tried to not drink, the more I drank. The more I tried to not drink, I drank not only more, I drank earlier. Now instead of drinking at 5 o'clock, I'm drinking at 3 o'clock. I said, pretty soon I'm going to be drinking this out of a cereal box for breakfast. I was worried about myself. So, I'll just do a week of wine. Oh, my husband didn't like that because they had to have more wine than scotch. So he said, are you fixing another drink? So you know what I did? I filled the bottom of the sink with glasses and filled them all up with wine at the same time. And he said, "Are you getting another drink?" I said, "No, honey, I'm just getting ice." And then I didn't, he didn't hear the clink of the bottle. And I would just have my wine until it was all gone. And he said, "I don't understand how one glass of wine can get you so drunk." I said, "Honey, I'm just tired." So he said, "You are tired. The other night, you had a glass of wine and I couldn't wake you up. And do you remember I carried you to bed?" I said, "No." I said, "You carried me to bed?" He said, "Yes." I said, "You should have told me." And he said, "Well, you were sleeping." I said, "Okay," because he was gone for the next couple of weeks on another one of his trips, you know. So I was really, it was getting like I couldn't stay sober. He wants to go on a trip. I don't know how I'm going to get the alcohol on the trip. I'm certainly not taking an airplane. You know, it was so I'm giving him logistical problems. That's what he called them. About, you know, how to get me where he wanted me to go and me go there and I had to have my alcohol and he couldn't know how much alcohol I was drinking. So even though he was having it charged and delivered, he should have had a hint about how much alcohol I was drinking. And I was getting like I was more interested in drinking than doing anything else. And one day I thought, you know what, I've just got to be a better mother than this. I'm going to have to make sure I get Kathy to school. And I thought, school? When's school? School's tomorrow. I got to get back. I almost missed her first day of school. And in all the, you know, clamor getting her into school and everything, all of a sudden I finally have time to read the newspaper and I'm reading about Nixon resigned. I'm going around, "Did you know Nixon resigned?" They go, "Mickey, that was 3 weeks ago." "I missed the resignation of the President of the United States. I am drinking too much. I'm just really not doing well." And so I thought, I better have a talk with my husband. And so I sat him down one night. I said, "You know, I really think I need some help. I think before I know what help I need, I'm going to have to sleep until I wake up." He said, "No, you'll never wake up." I said, "I just want a hotel room." He said, "No, you don't deserve a hotel room." And I started unintentionally crying, and there were only two tears, one on my right eye and one on my left. And they were so hot, they were burning my face. And he said, "If you're going to cry, I'm going to leave the room." I said, "Well, then you'll have to leave the room because obviously I am crying." And I got up, and I only had the littlest amount of alcohol still in my glass. And I poured it down the sink. And symbolically, I think that's the first drop of alcohol I ever threw away. I just knew I had to get away from him. I had to change my life. And I thought, I've got to get a divorce. Now, I had filed for divorce in Rhode Island. I had filed for divorce in New Jersey. This would be my first time to file for divorce in Houston. Eventually, I filed for divorce in Dallas. I filed twice in Atlanta, you know. So it was hard for me, and that will come up a little later in my story. But I finally decided I just have to go to Alcoholics Anonymous. The next morning, I was trying to button little Cindy's coat, and I couldn't find the buttonholes, and the coat was making me dizzy. And so I called Alcoholics Anonymous, and they told me later, when they unlocked the office door that morning, the phone was ringing, and it was me. And I said, "Is it too late? Have I spoiled it? Have I ruined it for my children? They've got a drunk mom." And they said, "No, it's not too late. And by the way, how old are they?" I said, 8 and 2. "No, it's not too late. You can go to AA." So then finally I get into Alcoholics Anonymous and they sit me down next to a guy who had the death rattle. And they said, "Sit down, talk to him, you two have a lot in common." I saw it cheapest. I spent 3 hours picking out my outfit for this meeting and finally settled on pantsuit and curls. You know, and he was the epitome of what I was afraid Alcoholics Anonymous would be. But I didn't care how they looked. I just was afraid they wouldn't accept me in AA. I thought, they're just going to have to accept me because I can't stop drinking. So they went through a step one meeting and told me all about themselves, you know how the step one meetings go. And at the end, they start giving out these chips. They go, well, wait a minute. How do you stop drinking? And he said, well, you just don't drink one day at a time. I said, and that's it? I said, you could have put that in the paper. I couldn't believe it. I felt like, what is this? You know, that was a short little sentence, you know? So he said, no, Mickey, you have to come to 30 meetings in 30 days. I said, what man thought of that? I haven't been out of the house 30 nights in a row since I got married. I haven't even been out of the house 2 nights in a row since I got married. Actually, this is my first night out of my neighborhood. And it was a Friday night. They said, you have to come to 30 meetings in 30 days. I said, you won't be seeing me again. So they said, well, take a chip. I said, I don't want a chip. It's a surrender chip. I don't care what it is. My daughter will bring it to school for show and tell. Keep your chip. And this guy, French, he was trying to tell me I was going to die. I thought, I don't know if I'm going to die, but I'm going to go home and do what you said and ask God to keep me sober, and I will thank him at the end of the day. I thought, I'm just going to do it. I got to do it. I can't get out of the house 30 days in a row. I'll never be able to do it. So I went home, and I did what he said and stayed sober, and about a week later, I thought, I'll go back and tell Frenchie I'm doing okay. So I go back to my second AA meeting a week later. Frenchie wasn't there. I go, where's that guy Frenchie? They go, I don't know. I say, you mean he doesn't come here every Friday night? They go, no. With the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. I thought, you know what? There's a lot of love in this room, and there's a lot of respect in this room, and I'm coming back. So I found out about an AA meeting for women for the big book, only I didn't have a big book. And I didn't have the money for a big book, so I didn't know what I was going to do for a big book. And this guy said, well, you're going to go to that big book meeting? I said, well, I don't have the money for a 12, you know, that big book. So he said, I'll get you that book. So he bought my book. And every day, if I brought that home and my husband came home, he'd get mad at me. And he said, the only place I want that book is up in the attic. So I put it up in the attic. If I wanted to read it, I went up in the attic, came down, read it, put it back up in the attic. On Thursdays, I would bring it to the meeting, make sure I put it back up in the attic. I think that's where my kids thought I hung, you know, hid the Christmas presents and everything. In the meantime, my husband doesn't know it, but I've talked to the guys about starting some daytime AA meetings because I realize the people who are going to AA are getting better quicker than I was. And so I start going to some daytime meetings, and the guys go with me, and I found a babysitting co-op where I could exchange time and I didn't need money, and I'm going to meetings during the day. So that really worked out well. And just before we got transferred from Houston to Dallas, I was invited to this very ritzy home. And in this house, it was filled with women who were sober alcoholics, whom I had never seen at the AA clubhouse. And they said that they thought they would be afraid to go to an AA clubhouse. And I said, why? And they said, well, I'm afraid that something will happen to me. I said, like, what? And she said, I don't know. We were just told, don't go to the AA clubhouse. And she told me she had 16 years and no one had ever asked her to be a sponsor. I said, well, how can anyone ask you if you're not at the AA clubhouse? You know, I said, I've adjusted to a lot of things, and I don't see anything happen at the AA clubhouse that you can't handle. I said, I've got some new friends. They're not exactly what my mother would pick. One of my favorites was Kungass. A big dog. He was another one. But I learned so much from them. I said, I can't believe you've been trying to get sober in a living room. You know, that's where I drank. That's the last place I needed to be. So I decided right then and there, no matter what happened in my life, no matter what happened in AA, I was going to keep going to meetings. Moved to Dallas, and so much of my higher power was through the fellowship of AA that I just was in crisis. I missed my home group so much. But I made more friends, and I was concentrating on trying to do some of those steps, but with more integrity. At first, I didn't do the steps. I kind of just drifted over the steps. I was thinking, surely there must be secret AA, and this is like hazing. But no, after a couple of years, I realized this is the only thing. So I'm going to do the steps, and I'm going to do them with integrity. And so I decide I'm going to try to do some amends that I owed back in New Jersey. So, but I'm playing games with God. I'm saying, you know, if you really want me to make an amend to this lady, make sure she's outside her house. It was freezing, so naturally she wasn't outside a house. I go back to Dallas, haven't made the amend. I do another fourth and fifth step. There she is again. I thought, I got to go make an amend, only this time I'm going to have to knock on the door. This is getting expensive, but I'm going. Fortunately, my girlfriend was finding her way to get me up there, and I did, and when I got to this house, there was a moving van in the driveway and a for sale sign on the lawn and sold sign over it. And I didn't know if she was in the house moving out or the new person was moving in. Fortunately, she was moving out. I knocked on the door. I said, I don't want to keep you. Obviously, you're moving, but I want to make an amend. She goes, you want to make an amend? I said, yes. I would like to make an amend if I hurt you in any way, in any shape or any style, for any reason. And I just want to say I'm sorry for any stress I caused you or anything that I did that hurt your feelings. She said, well, I never thought I would hear those words from you. I said, well, here you are. You're hearing those words from me. So I want to wish you the best, and you're moving, and so good luck. And I say goodbye to her. I always considered myself very fortunate to complete that amend. It was one of the biggest things I did while I was in Dallas. But, of course, 2.5 years later, we have to move again because I've been with IBM. I've been moved. So we moved to Atlanta. I have almost 5 years of sobriety. And the first meeting I go to is down Holy Family Church. And the second meeting I went to was the Abernathy, and that's my home group. So I very, very much loved the people immediately. I had many, many people that asked me to be their sponsor. Now there's more women in AA. It wasn't like when I first came in. We're having a lot of fun. There was only one problem. Every time some woman needed help, you had to take her to a different lady's house. And we were like all over the city. One day we'd be in Lilburn, the next day we'd be in Buckhead, then we'd be in Roswell, then we were in East Cobb. I said, this would confuse me if I were trying to get sober. So I was talking to some of the women about it. And lo and behold, we got asked to pick up a woman on a Saturday morning. So my friend Marsha and I went to pick up this lady, Judy, and we went all the way down to the Napa Clubhouse and couldn't get in. There were no parking spaces. And obviously there wasn't anything that was going to move because they were packed and they were like sardines. So we took Judy to a coffee house, I think Coco's was the name of it, told her about the steps, told her about, you know, we'd pick her up, we'd take her here Monday, there Tuesday. She'd go, oh, okay. And I said, after we dropped off Judy, I said, Marsha, we need a clubhouse on the north side of town. And she goes, how are we going to do that, Mickey? I said, we're going to ask the men. The men in AA are going to help us because they'll understand this can't go on. So the next Thursday night at the Abernathy group, I asked the men if they would help us get an AA clubhouse, and they were nodding up and down. I said, we need a place, but we cannot do it without the men. And they went like this, and they started to get a committee, and then they heard about a guy named Doc who had helped start a clubhouse up in Ohio, and he kind of knew the logistics. And Doc was just immeasurably useful. And the committee found a house, and that became the 8111 Club. And that was just such a blessing, and that we could slip those AA meetings in there for women during the day. And then eventually, after 1983, we put them in at the 4 p.m. meeting every day. And it was such a relief to not feel like we had to take them somewhere every day. They could find their place, one place, and know at least they could go to a meeting. We started 11:30 a.m. and 1 p.m. meetings for the kids on a split shift at Roswell High School and Walton High School, the teachers included. And we was going to meetings out in the horse farms of Alpharetta, and we could bring those meetings indoors. I mean, it was fun on the field, but it was buggy. So, you know, it was kind of nice to come indoors. And I got to oversee that and eventually got asked to go to work at Peachwood Hospital, and I don't want to, you know, go on with that. But I really consider that contribution of everybody working together one of the greatest things AA has done in this city. I worked. Things were not good at home. My husband's not being supportive of my job. He's beginning to get nasty to the children. And so once again, I filed for divorce. Only this time, I'm more calm. I'm not as edgy. I have 9 years of sobriety at this point. I picked a landmark, and I realized, you know, Mickey, you have got to pray for courage. You are not taking any risks. You've got to do what you got to do to get the promises of this program. So the first thing I thought, well, we'll try it out. I tried to quit smoking, got everybody to help me, and I managed to quit smoking. We had a lot of laughs with that. And then I filed for divorce and managed to do that. And in my family, if you had a problem, you prayed about it, you got a master's degree. So I knew what was expected of me. So I decided, well, I don't have much time because I have to sell this house. I have to find something for me, Kathy, and Cindy to live in, and all the dogs and cats and guinea pigs. So I just said, I'm just going to write away to Princeton and tell them to send any scores they have with my name and social security number to UGA Social School or the Georgia State University Counseling School. I just did that, told my story in Winder, mentioned that I very much wanted to get into a master's program, and in the audience was somebody from the Board of Regents. He said, if there's any school in Georgia you cannot get into, I want you to contact me personally, because there shouldn't be any school in Georgia you wouldn't be welcomed into. That was such a comfort to me. But I still knew I had a big road to hoe. I sold the house. I got us a little house. I had prayed to keep Cindy in her school. And we found a house, a little house, right on the street of her school. I just knew my higher power was watching over us. It was scary running the finances. Sometimes I'd be doing the checks on a Sunday. I'd only have 14 cents left over in the balance, but the bills were paid. And I'd have another paycheck coming in the next Friday. Thank you, Sally. Then a couple of months later, I'm doing the checkbook. Now I have 37 cents. See, my problems are twice as good. Every night I go to bed and I go to sleep and I say the Lord's Prayer. And I really hooked into that, give us this day our daily bread. That was really just encompassed the fact that our needs were met. I had a full tank of gas, the bills were paid, I had a job, and lo and behold, what comes in the mail but a letter accepting me into Georgia State University School of Counseling. I never had applied. I never filled out an application. And this letter came, I called them up, I think you've made a mistake. I have not filled in an application. They said, well, you sent us your scores. I said, oh, yeah. Did you get some scores? He said, yes. He said, with those scores, you're in. I said, really? I'm just in? He said, you're in. So now I had to find someone to teach me how to use MARTA, because I didn't know how to use MARTA. So I got a guy at work and a couple of the cleaning crew to teach me how to use MARTA. We all went to Georgia State University for a few weeks. Well, it taught me, you get off here, Mickey, you change trains here, Mickey, and we all helped Mickey get her degree. And it was really a good feeling to know I was working on something that was going to solve our financial problems. And Kathleen went on to North Georgia College and eventually got onto the board at North Georgia College. Cindy went into UGA. She graduated with honors. And she now has a very successful job up in Roswell. And I managed to open a private practice, which I just love doing. So I really am a very blessed person. And my parents eventually were very, very proud of me. And I've learned to use this program in different ways so I can keep growing with it. At the millennium, I wrote my parents a letter of amends. They said it made them cry. But, you know, it's just different ways to use the tools and different ways to grow and different ways to be closer. And I don't have any regrets today. I know that our program has helped clean those up. And so by cleaning that up, I can really commit to today and commit to the future. And I don't have to worry too much. As long as I don't do anything illegal or immoral today, I should be okay, right? And I don't take a drink. That's the most important thing. You know, Tramp Marie died when I had about 19 years of sobriety, and we really missed that dog because she was our sober dog. But the neat thing was that my daughter Kathy got married. She met a guy named Ben, and he just loved Kathy, and he took her for a 3-week honeymoon to Europe. That was just such a wonderful thing. It's not like they lived on the Taj Mahal. They lived, you know, probably on the ground, I don't know. But they were married, so I didn't care. The neat thing was he came back. He said, you know those meetings Kathy goes to? This was my first call from a new son-in-law. You know those meetings Kathy goes to? I said, you mean those ACOA meetings? He goes, yes. I thought, don't tell me. He's going to say he doesn't want her to go to meetings. I thought, yes, Ben. He goes, don't you think if she has to know about alcoholism and all those things, I should too, and I should go to those meetings? I said, yes, Ben, you should go to those meetings. And I realized my higher power has sent me the perfect son-in-law. The perfect son-in-law. They have 4 children. My first grandchildren right now, my only grandchildren, Zachary Quinn, Brogan Gabriel, Oliver Joseph, and then Gretchen Marie. So I'm very, very lucky. They live in Cobb. I get to see them. They're not alienated from me. Kathy and Cindy have both done a lot of Alateen, Al-Anon, ACOA work, and know about the disease and being careful about knowing that it runs in the family. I don't keep secrets from them. I don't want them to keep secrets, and Kathy and Ben are committed to telling the children when it's appropriate that they're going to have to also watch out for what comes with that. I don't know what I should have told you, but one thing I know, somewhere along the line I found out the first word in the Serenity Prayer is not Mickey. It's God. It's not as hard to do it when you use the tools of the program, but the most important tool of all that I almost completely missed and cheated myself out of was the fellowship. I think that's the first promise, that we don't have to be alone anymore. And my friends, I have friends in many, many cities. I hope I make more friends this weekend. Have just been priceless to me. The courage that I've felt from everybody, keep on keeping on. And some people have had things much worse than I have. But today I don't have to worry so much about money, but I think I'll be picking up money forever. If I see a penny, I'm going to get it. But because I got a scholarship to college, I decided to pay it back. And when I paid back my scholarship, my college asked me to be on the foundation board. And because they asked me to be on the foundation board, I decided to fund a scholarship. It's going to go for something to do with a kid that's trying to get a degree and needs some help in a special way for special reasons, the kind like you and I have. And I'm going to name it after my mom and dad. That will emerge about 1906 or 07. I cannot tell you how grateful I am. I hope you get everything and better. Everything that happened for me and then some, and I'd love to hear about it. I want to thank you for listening to me. I want to thank the Abernathy Group for coming to support me. I want to thank Sally for the nice introduction and the committee for allowing me to come up here and share my story. See you at a meeting. Bye.